for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN approves a new peacekeeping force for the CAR, and a Cameroon polio vaccination targets the CAR and Nigerian refugees. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The UN Security Council has approved an expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. The 15-nation council unanimously approved a UN-led force of 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police. The force will become operational in September and replace an African Union peacekeeping mission. The 6,000 African soldiers and 2,000 French troops have been unable to contain interreligious violence that has killed thousands of people and forced 1 million from their homes. Cameroon has announced a special polio vaccination campaign for all children after half a dozen cases were identified. There are fears that children fleeing dangerous situations in neighboring countries such as terrorist violence in Nigeria, one of a few nations which have not eradicated polio, are spreading the virus. Cameroon's Minister of Health says a whole country needs to be on alert to protect every child from the crippling and potentially fatal virus. He says they thought that we could declare Cameroon polio-free, but unfortunately we have detected 4 cases of the wild polio virus in the west of the country. South African runner Oscar Pistorius returned to the witness stand in his murder trial today. Prosecutors tried to portray him as self-centered in his relationship with girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. Here we hear the lead prosecutor, Jerry Nail, focusing on the apology Pistorius made, and it first began his testimony this week.
My counsel has been in contact with Steenkamp's legal representatives, and they weren't ready to meet with me, my lady, which I understand. So that's why it was not done.
At court, did you try? You know that other people spoke to Ms. Steenkamp. Did you try and do that?
I didn't think it would be appropriate, my lady, in front of everyone that's here. It's...
And then you do it when the whole world's on you. Every person listening to this court, it was appropriate to do it then. How can that be?
Pistorius added that he did not have the chance to meet with Steenkamp's family and that he believed they would not talk to him. Nell also brought up 3 lesser firearm-related charges in the case. You can follow all details about the testimony in this trial at voanews.com. A bomb set off by suspected Maoist rebels killed 2 Indian soldiers and wounded at least 3 as voting got underway in eastern India's Bihar state. Authorities say a jeep carrying the soldiers to a polling station drove over a landmine in the Munger district. Maoist insurgents have urged voters to stay away from the polls and threatened to disrupt the election. Today's voting is the 3rd stage of Indian parliamentary elections. As the global economy continues to struggle to recover, Asia remains a bright spot, with developing countries still enjoying high rates of growth. At an international economic meeting in China today, the country's premier said that regional integration is the way forward.
Li Keqiang addressed an audience of businessmen and politicians from over 50 Asian countries at the opening ceremony of the Boao Forum, a regional economic meeting modeled after the World Economic Forum. In his remarks, Li stressed the need for more cooperation and trade between countries in Asia. Li acknowledged the challenges of cooperating in a region where territorial disputes routinely disrupt other areas of cooperation. He repeated China's commitment to resolving disputes in peaceful manner, but said that China will respond firmly to provocations. Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong for VOA.
A bomb blew up outside the Greek central bank in Athens this morning, hours before Greece returns to the international bond market. Police say the blast shattered windows but injured no one. Anonymous callers telephoned warnings to a newspaper and a news website about an hour before that blast. No one has claimed responsibility. Telephone warnings traditionally precede such attacks in Athens. Search crews have detected more underwater transmissions they believe could belong to the flight data recorder of that missing Malaysian jetliner. Australian authorities said a surveillance aircraft heard a possible signal today in the southern Indian Ocean. Its nearby ships heard similar sounds early this week. Search Chief Angus Houston said in a statement that the acoustic data will require further analysis overnight. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Hello. Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehia Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Food insecurity in Sudan could affect as many as 4 million people in the coming months. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames conflict, displacement, and poor harvests.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. Details next.
Also in the news, the UN Security Council approves an expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. And South African runner Oscar Pistorius returned to the witness stand today as prosecutors tried to portray him as self-centered in his relationship with his late girlfriend, Reba Steenkamp.
We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Niger, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Security Council unanimously agreed today to authorize a nearly 12,000-member UN peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. From UN headquarters, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The force, which will be known by the acronym MINUSCA, will take over on September 15th from the 6,000-troop African mission currently in the Central African Republic. The UN mission will have 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police. The Africans and about 2,000 French troops have been trying to restore calm in the Central African Republic following intercommunal fighting that erupted in December, with mainly Christian anti-Balaka militias attacking Muslim Seleka rebels in Bangui. Seleka forces overthrew the government just more than a year ago. International forces are trying to end continuing reprisal attacks and restore law and order to halt a growing humanitarian crisis that has displaced around 1 million people and left more than half the country's 4.6 million population in urgent need of aid. CAR Foreign Minister Toussaint Kongo Dudu welcomed the creation of the new force, saying the hopes of an entire nation ride on it. He is heard here through an interpreter.
Today, the adoption of this resolution authorizing the deployment of MINUSCA is the start of a decisive phase in the process of restoring peace and security and hence stabilizing the Central African Republic.
The minister said his country's transitional authorities are committed to national reconciliation, combating impunity, and holding national elections no later than next February. French Ambassador Gerard Arreau told reporters the African and French forces have been working hard on the ground, but the security situation remains volatile, and the authorization of MINUSCA will be a turning point.
Their mandate under Chapter 7 will focus on protection of civilians, restoration of law and order, support to humanitarian access, monitoring of human rights, and fight impunity.
The African troops will continue their military activities until the transfer date in September. Many of those troops may also join the new UN mission. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power visited the Central African Republic this week. She says the violence the country has witnessed has brought it to the edge of disaster.
Untold horrors continue in small villages throughout the countryside, and more than 19,000 Muslims are trapped in the capital, too afraid of anti-Balaka forces to leave their hiding places.
She said the United States would continue its assistance to the country. Washington has committed up to $100 million to support restoring security and an additional $67 million for humanitarian needs since January. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
More than 30 people, most of them civilian bystanders, died in a four-hour gun battle between Christian and Muslim militias Tuesday in the Central African Republic. The shootout occurred in the town of Diekowa, 170 miles north of the capital, Bangui. Local police and a priest in the town confirmed the deaths. The latest violence in the four-month conflict began when Christian militia called anti-Balaka attacked Muslim Seleka Alliance forces. The Seleka called in reinforcements. Police said most of the dead were civilians hit by stray bullets. Another eight were reported wounded.
The United States has handed over dozens of vehicles to the African Union military force in the Central African Republic. It promised 200 more as well as more funding for peacekeeping. For VOA, Nick Long reports from the CAR capital, Bangui.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, was in Bangui to look at plans for converting the current African Union mission here into a UN peacekeeping mission. Power attended a ceremony Wednesday at the base of the African Union mission MISCA, where she praised the peacekeepers' sacrifices. More than 20 men of the African mission and 2 men of the French military mission Sangaris have fallen in the line of duty since December. She said the situation has not calmed yet, but told the peacekeepers they have prevented a much greater catastrophe from unfolding.
As terrible as the situation here remains, it would be far worse if not for your efforts to protect civilians, disarm militia, and create areas where families can be safe. I commend you on behalf of President Obama and the United States for your brave service and urge you to persevere.
Ambassador Power said the U.S. has already contributed 37 vehicles to MISCA and is sending another 200, including trucks and armored vehicles. She said U.S. support for the mission, including airlifts and other assistance, totals more than $100 million. The AU mission is still facing the fallout from 2 incidents late last month in which Burundian and Chadian troops were accused of shooting dead a number of civilians in Bangui. Chad has since announced the withdrawal of its 850 troops from MISCA in the face of increasing hostility from many Central Africans. Ambassador Power expressed sympathy for the peacekeepers.
Even the best and bravest efforts can be misunderstood because they fail to achieve instant miracles. Peacekeepers deserve better. You may not be greeted by a parade when you return home, but please know that you have the world's gratitude for your courageous service.
The ambassador also told VOA she has been consulting widely on what the international community can do to help the Muslim communities in the Western CAR, which are still under threat, and whether it should do more to help them relocate to safer areas.
I think part of the challenge is getting a sense of what the individuals in these communities want. And often there are spokespersons for whole communities, and what I think the UN is trying to do is make sure we go on a case-by-case basis and not have a situation where anybody who wishes to leave somehow feels pressed to stay simply for the sake of showing that there's still diversity in the Central African Republic.
She said once the Security Council votes to authorize a UN mission, the military presence should be ramped up to prepare the AU mission for re-hatting as blue helmets from September the 15th, as the UN Secretary General has requested. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Food insecurity in Sudan could affect as many as 4 million people in the coming months. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames conflict, displacement, and poor harvests. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The FAO says currently there are 3.3 million food insecure people in Sudan. That figure is expected to rise by 700,000 due to a lack of availability and access to food. Roseanne Markosich is the agency's representative in Sudan.
The numbers are quite astonishing.
She says Sudan is facing what she calls an early lean season.
When the harvest is finished and the amount of locally available food is diminished, that's what the lean season is.
Markosich says food support is needed for millions of households in Sudan. The reasons are many.
We have the issue of conflict. You see that in the Blue Nile, South Kordofan, and especially in Darfur right now. And you see huge displacements. There were about 380,000 people displaced just in 2013. And in the new year, up until the figures of April the 7th, we see an additional displacement of 280,000 people just in the Darfur region alone.
And livelihoods play a role as well.
Lack of economic opportunities for the people, which result in conflict, issue of natural resource management, conflict between farmers and agriculturalists and herders, for example. And then you also see drought and flood. So it's really a combination of human disaster and natural disaster, a combination of the two.
The lack of availability of food in many places in Sudan has caused food prices to jump.
You can see an increase in food prices at about 84% for meat, 45% for sugar, 40% for vegetables, and 70% for transport, which is very much linked to access and availability of the food.
The conflict in South Sudan only adds to the situation as refugees cross the border seeking safer haven.
It is very, very important that we continue to provide the people and the host communities and the returnees and also those people in IDP camps with seed so that they can plant. And many are leaving the camps and returning back to their homes, and they're returning to nothing. So these people need to have seeds and tools so that they can plant and have a harvest.
Besides thousands of metric tons of seed, the FAO official says nearly 1 million farming tools need to be distributed. What's more, Sudanese herders need help too.
We need to ensure that the herders' livestock is vaccinated, that they are receiving fodder to keep their animals healthy, because having livestock is not only a very important status symbol for the families, but it is a way of ensuring nutrition security as well as food security, because it is a source of protein and its byproducts, either through dairy or through eggs or through the meat that is consumed.
More than 11.5 million livestock would be vaccinated under the FAO plan. The UN agency says its interventions would cost $19 million. So far, donors have provided $7 million. So animal vaccinations and farming tool distribution are far short of the target numbers. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Libyan military says it has regained control of at least one oil-exporting port in the east of the country. This follows days of negotiations with separatists demanding a larger share of oil revenues. An agreement to open two ports has been reached, but negotiations continue. Edward Iranian reports from Cairo.
Agreement by the two sides to reopen oil ports after a nine-month militia blockade was hailed as a breakthrough after a long and bitter tug of war. Talks between the interim government and the separatist militia occupying the ports had been going on for days. Justice Minister Ali Mirghani told journalists the government would set up a commission to investigate alleged financial improprieties as demanded by the separatists.
هذه النقاط تتمثل في فتح الموانئ على دفعتين.
He said the government reached an agreement with the separatists to open the ports of Zweitina and Harega immediately while reopening the ports of Sidra and Ras Lanuf west of Benghazi within 2 to 4 weeks. But he added talks are continuing over Ras Lanuf and Sidra. The Ras Lanuf and Sidra ports remain under control of militia commander Ibrahim Jadran, who is an ally of the self-proclaimed separatist regional government of Barka. Libyan military spokesman Colonel Ali Sheikhi says the port of Harega is now under government control.
اليوم 9 أبريل 2014
He says Harega port is now in the hands of the Libyan National Oil Company and under operational control of the Arab Gulf Oil Company in order to resume oil exports. Unconfirmed reports on Arab TV channels indicate militiamen may still be blocking operations at the Zweitina port. But a spokesman for the separatist Barka Regional Authority insisted two of the four ports it was occupying have been handed back to the government. He also said discussions would continue over the fate of the final two ports his group controls, but a financial arrangement with the government had yet to be reached. He claimed government operations of the facilities in the past were tainted by fraud. Libya exported up to 3.5 million barrels of oil per day before the uprising against ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi began in February of 2011. The central government says it needs to resume exports in order to fund its operations. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Coming up, up on 20 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A UN study of intentional homicides around the world says that post-conflict cattle raiding in South Sudan's Windlet Triangle produced one of the highest murder rates in the world. The study by the UN Office of Drugs and Crime attributed the rate, 60 homicides per 100,000 population, to many weapons being available following Sudan's civil war, a war that led to the establishment of South Sudan. The global average is 6.2 homicides per 100,000 population. In contrast, the UN agency offers encouraging numbers for Sierra Leone and Liberia, due in part to reconciliation processes and gradual improvement of security. Their capitals, however, remain homicide hotspots.
South African runner Oscar Pistorius returned to the witness stand today as prosecutors tried to portray him as self-centered in his relationship with girlfriend Riva Steenkamp. Lead prosecutor Huddy Nail focused early on the apology Pistorius made when he first began his testimony this week, saying the athlete chose to make a spectacle in the courtroom rather than apologize in private. Pistorius said he did not have the chance to meet with Steenkamp's family and that he believed they would not want to talk to him. Nail also brought up the three lesser firearm-related charges in the case, which involve allegations of a gun going off in a restaurant and a car, as well as illegally possessing certain ammunition. Pistorius said his understanding was that he was not illegally in possession of the ammunition, that his finger was not on the trigger when the gun went off at the restaurant, and that witnesses lied about the other incident. Nail repeatedly accused Pistorius of not taking responsibility and being a negligent firearm owner.
Government ministers from 50 developing and donor nations will gather in Washington tomorrow for the UN-sponsored third biennial Sanitation and Water for All meeting. Recent global reports show that lack of safe water and sanitation continues to devastate the lives of 2.5 billion people. It also kills an estimated 1,400 children every day and keeps people in poverty. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will open the meeting. Conferees will discuss the status of pledged funds and efforts to bring safe water, sanitation, and hygiene to those most in need. Barbara Frost is chief executive of WaterAid, a nonprofit organization based in London. She says the crisis in water and sanitation simply cannot wait.
The latest figures have just come out showing that still 748 million people around the world still living without safe water to drink. And even more outrageous is the fact that 2.5 billion people are living without basic toilets. And of course, that has huge impact in terms of health status and also has an impact on water as well, because unless there's decent sanitation, often water is being polluted.
It has been well noted that lack of safe water and sanitation leads to diseases and even death, especially in children. Would you describe for us the effect of lack of clean water on children?
The estimates are that a child dies every single minute as a result of diarrheal diseases, which are due to poor water, in contaminated water. And that's from a range of causes, bacterial infections, worm infestations, etc., which are brought about by having to drink water that's dirty, that's come from a long way away from the home, and that's contaminated. And the impact on children, both in terms of illness, but also in terms of what it does for their education, because often children don't get to school because they're out collecting water or because they're sick from poor water. And then for girls, they often drop out of school at puberty because there are a lack of decent toilets, and so they just stop going.
What do you hope will be accomplished at this meeting?
A number of finance ministers and ministers for water, sanitation and health are coming together. And it's the third meeting of the Sanitation and Water for All Partnership. And the aim is to look at the pledges that they made 2 years ago, to look at progress against that, and also to look at what needs to be done to to really make progress on this crisis of water and sanitation. So it's about accountability, it's about political prioritisation, and it's about the nuts and bolts, what really is needed to get safe water to people and to get decent toilets and improved hygiene.
What can countries do now to try to remedy this life-threatening problem of lack of safe, clean water?
Well, from the developing countries' point of view, obviously it's prioritising it. With rapid urbanisation, the issue of poor sanitation, lack of basic toilets is really exacerbating. And as we know, you know, half the world population now lives in urban areas. So investing part of good planning in improved removal of human waste and in terms of making sure that there is good water available to all their citizens, not just those that live in the middle class and the upper class areas, but those that live in the peri-urban areas, in the areas where people have moved into cities. And from the development partners' point of view, it's making sure that they're working with those governments to invest in their plans, to work in a collaborative and coordinated fashion to make sure this crisis can be eradicated or alleviated.
How then do you get countries to make clean water a top priority?
That is one of the difficult issues. I think both to get those that are providing aid financing to prioritise it, because obviously that then helps those who are delivering to prioritise as well. And so the message is about how important improved water and sanitation are for the delivery of all the Millennium Development Goals and looking forward for poverty eradication. You know, the world's been talking about 2030 eradicating extreme poverty and without water and sanitation.
Based on pledges and commitments that are going to be made, I guess, this week, looking ahead, what do you expect 2 years from now?
We hope and we expect that there will be ongoing good progress and faster progress, particularly in sanitation. When you look at the latest figures that have come out, looking at the coverage of water and sanitation, it's countries in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia that are particularly off track in terms of sanitation. The MDGs won't be met, and the MDGs, as we know, are only about halving the numbers of people living without those services. So in 2 years' time, what we hope for is a lot more progress in these areas, because that way it will promote, as I said, better economic and social development, as well as being more toilets in people's homes or close to their homes.
That was Barbara Frost, Chief Executive of WaterAid. She spoke with me from Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yisroel in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Love African music?
Music Time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Security Council adopts a resolution today authorizing a new expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. And food insecurity in Sudan could affect as many as 4 million people in the coming months. Coming up, music from Niger and our series on the anniversary of Rwanda's genocide. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand African athletics tops your sports report today.
Kim, our starting line on the Sunny Side of Sports is African athletics. Sunday's London Marathon will feature a stellar African field, perhaps the greatest collection of running talent ever assembled for the marathon distance. Among those who will be on the starting line in the British capital are Kenya's Wilson Kipsang, the current world record holder for the marathon, Uganda's Stephen Kiprotich, the reigning world and Olympic marathon champion, Ethiopia's Segaye Kibede, the defending London Marathon champion, Kenya's Emmanuel Mutai, who we heard from on Wednesday's Sunny Side of Sports, and who is the London course record holder, and Somalia-born Mo Farah, who won gold medals for host Britain at 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters at the 2012 London Olympics. Mo will be making his debut at the classic 42-kilometer marathon distance. Another notable competitor in London is Ethiopia's Ibrahim Jaylan, who won a world title at 10,000 meters in 2011, and who, like Mo Farah, is also making his marathon debut. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Ibrahim ahead of Sunday's big race. Here's Andy.
We're talking with Ibrahim Jaylan of Ethiopia, who's a former world champion at 10,000 metres on the track, but he's making his marathon debut in the Virgin Money London Marathon on Sunday. Ibrahim, are you feeling good before your first marathon?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
And how's your training gone? You say if you're feeling good, have you had to change things because you have been a track runner?
Why I say I am good, I was prepared very well. That is why I'm saying I'm good. Yeah, I was preparing very well with, even if I am not marathon runner, I was preparing with marathon runner. And coach of marathon runners, so he was coaching me. And he told me I can do something good.
There's a great tradition of the marathon in Ethiopia. Of course, we think of Abebe Bikila, the double Olympic champion, and now Haile Gebrselassie, and so many great runners. Would that be special for you if you could become a really top marathon runner?
Yeah, it will be great thing if I able to run fast time and I able to win Olympic or World Championship again in marathon. It will be great thing for me.
Has that been a childhood dream? Because I know Haile has talked about being inspired by Abebe Bikila, his Olympic wins in 1960 and 1964. Was that an inspiration to make you start running?
Yeah, also, you know, I was watching when Haile running in 10,000, I think 2003 in Olympic, and also the other athletes when they are running in World Championship. I was watching them, so I started.
And do you have a target time? You think, well, if I run this kind of time, I would be happy with my first marathon?
Yeah, I will be happy if I run under 2:06.
Well, Ibrahim Jaylan, we wish you every success with your marathon debut on Sunday in the Virgin Money London Marathon 2014. All the best, Ibrahim. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
The energetic Andy Edwards also caught up with the London Marathon's defending women's champion.
Priska Cheptoo of Kenya is the Virgin Money London Marathon defending women's champion for this 2014 edition of the race. Priska, you produced a great performance last year to win, to beat the world champion Edna Kiplagat. Are you in the kind of form, similar form, this time round?
Yes, this year I also have trained well and everything has gone well, so I'm ready to go with any toughness or anything which happened on Sunday, so I'm ready.
Did the win in London last year give you an even greater boost to your confidence? You had such a great last 12 months or so, but was London especially special?
To win London last year, it's also pushed my confidence, and also this year, I'm trying to lower my time.
Well, your personal best is just outside 2 hours 20. Is that a goal as well? Perhaps secondary to winning again, but you want to break 2:20?
Yes, of course I would like to break 2:20 because I have stuck there. So this year I would like to improve it.
It is perhaps the strongest women's field there's ever been. We've got Tiki Galana, the Olympic champion from Ethiopia, and then Tirunesh Dibaba making her debut at the marathon. Do you think the Ethiopians in particular will be dangerous?
I know this year we have a strong field. My colleagues from Kenya, athletes, and also Ethiopians. And that is good for me because we shall elevate each other, and also I know we shall run good on Sunday.
So the stronger the field, in a way now, you feel confident enough, you think, yeah, that's good that it's a tough field.
Yeah, it's a strong field because everybody I know, she has prepared well for this race, and I know everyone, she's strong according to what she has done before last season. So it is good because when you have a strong feel, we improve our time.
Well, the world record for the women's only race is 2 hours 17 minutes 42, set by Britain's Paula Radcliffe. That's perhaps out of reach, or maybe not, the way you're talking. Do you think there's a chance that might be broken?
It might be broken. It is not something difficult, but on Sunday, the day will tell out itself. So I hope we will try.
All the best. Priska Cheptoo, the defending champion of the Virgin Money London Marathon 2014. Good luck on Sunday.
Thank you.
Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny, and good evening to all our listeners around Africa.
David, let's turn to your backyard now in South Africa. And you said there's going to be some exciting finishes in the English and Spanish leagues. How about in the South African Premiership?
That's right, Sonny. We had a huge game here at the weekend at Soccer City in Soweto, a big crowd in the 94,000 Soccer City Stadium. And it pitted the leaders, Kaizer Chiefs, against a team in second place, 3 points behind them, Mamelodi Sundowns. Now, while Chiefs supporters will never agree with me on this, in terms of building to an exciting climax to the competition, it was imperative that Sundowns win. And that's exactly what they did. It was a strange goal. In fact, the Chiefs coach, Stuart Baxter, called the goal a joke. And remember, that's what Jose Mourinho said last week when Chelsea were beaten 3-1 by Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League quarterfinal first leg. He said that the third goal by the French club was a joke.
The game was under control. We had the 2-1 to score in the end of the first half, which would be a fantastic result, obviously. For the second half, we didn't score. After that, we scored in our own goal. And after that, the third goal is a joke. It's not a goal, it's a joke.
that phrase was picked up on by Baxter. Now, the reason they called it a joke was because Teko Medise, the Sundowns midfielder, he lobbed the ball towards the goal mouth from just inside the Chiefs' half. I don't think he had the slightest intention of scoring. But what happened, Sonny, is the ball bounced. It eluded attackers. It eluded the defenders. And it also, crucially, eluded Chiefs goalkeeper Etumeleng Khune back after an injury absence. And lo and behold, the lob that was simply meant to set up an attack ended up in the back of the corner of the net, and that was the only goal. Sundowns won 1-0, and now they and Chiefs are level on 52 points each, and all that separates them is one goal on goal difference. Chiefs have got a plus 21 goal difference, and Sundowns have got a plus 20, and there are five rounds to go. I still feel, Sonny, that Chiefs are favourites, but what we now have is the potential for a really exciting climax to the South African Premiership season.
Still in South Africa, David, the country hosted a very successful World Cup in 2010, and yet there's still some controversy that took place prior to the World Cup, FIFA launching a probe into alleged match fixing. Can you give us some details on that?
Yes, Sonny. Prior to the World Cup, South Africa played a number of friendlies, and there are big question marks about the refereeing in them. I reported on those games for the French news agency AFP, and I remember looking back now at my reports, questioning a lot of the penalties. I used words like strange and bizarre. I mean, some of the penalties were, to put it mildly, ridiculous. I was also curious as to why, for matches in Southern Africa, we had referees from places like Togo and Niger. Now, the tradition, Sonny, for friendly matches in Southern Africa is you use referees from other Southern African countries. I mean, basically, you're looking after your own. And also, vitally these days, given economic situation, you're cutting down on costs. I mean, why would you bring a referee all the way from Lomé in West Africa when you can bring one from Maputo or Mbambani or Maseru? It's a short flight, or in some cases, even just a car drive. Anyway, these matches were won decisively in some cases by South Africa, 4-0 against Thailand and then 5-0 against Guatemala, which to me was the most bizarre game of them all. South Africa were awarded three penalties, and I think two of them, let's just say that I was surprised they were awarded.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, our series on the 20th anniversary of Rwanda's genocide. And next, the World Bank completes a preliminary report on Tunisia's development policy. But first, some music. Here is Kaidan Gaskia of Niger with Africa.
Oh Lord, Africa, hey. Yes, man, for a piece of love, not in Africa. For lights, God bless Africa. Africa, Africa. What's up now?
Africa dance, slay. My people crying, slay. Every day,
slay.
Oh, yo, man, I'll be the love night ever, right? Hey. Hey.
Les bombes bagages nationales, les bombes chimiques nationales, les bombes atomiques nationales, les bombes nucléaires nationales, les chars de guerre nationales, les armes de guerre nationales, l'avion de guerre nationale, l'avion de guerre nationale.
Mon rêve, c'est de voir l'Afrique s'unir. Plus de guerre, plus de mort, plus de génocide. Mon rêve, c'est de voir une Afrique libre, libre d'opinion, d'expression, tu le sais. Africa dance, my people crying, every day.
Slay.
Oh yo, it must be the love that you ever write. Hey, Africa done, my people crying, every day.
Slay.
Oh yo, it must be the love that you ever write.
hey, hey, hey. Mwaska tunika dika di, mwaska tunika makama, mwaska tunika maise samse lokjo gunika kuipa, mwaska tunika maise samse lokjo sinika kuipa, mwaska tunika kaka kama, mwaska tunika baika bai, mwaska tunika baifa samse bani sika tipa. Alwatu kuni gunika di hankasi kano bise, alwatu kuni gunika di apikla baino gunika se, alwatu kuni gunika di borbila baino gunika se, alwatu kuni gunika di borbisa keno gunika se, alwatu kuni gunika di wonge ha wai bo hai gabu, alwatu kuni gunika di wonge ha sakai koga bu, alwatu kuni gunika di iko kace hakil gaba. Botunika ke mate apo apikla bay mate apo borbila bay mate apo borbisa ke mate apo egal shir mate apo pure hair pure and botunika ke mate apo pure bomb pure gum
Africa dance my people dance every day boy yo 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 it's one of the people love night like ever rise hey 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 Africa dance my people dance every day boy yo 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 it's one of the people love night like ever rise Hey hey hey,
man man man, tu sais, mon chemin a son initié. Mon Afrique est divisée, nos dirigeants sont dirigés. Yeah man, plus les Babylones déguisés. Ils ont mis l'Afrique en flamme, ils ne font que la tisser. Ce sont nos babysés, mon camarade Juna. Afrique, ça reste en soudé. Nous avons les mains dans la main, on veut toujours s'imposer. Mon cadre de système, divisé pour nous régner. Yeah Babylone, à la base de tous les coups d'état. Yeah Babylone, à la base de tous les attentats. Yeah Babylone, garde toutes tes tonnes d'armes et de bombes. Hey, 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 well, l'Afrique a besoin de l'unité. Well, l'Afrique a besoin de paix. Well, l'Afrique ne doit plus être endettée. Well, l'Afrique ne doit plus être enflammée. Well, c'est le berceau de l'humanité. C'est le berceau de l'humanité.
Africa.
We wanna be free, yeah.
Africa.
We wanna be free, yeah.
Africa dance, my people dance. Every day,
today.
Boy, yo, 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 it's one of the people love night like ever rise. Hey, 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 Africa done, my people crying every day. Oh, yo, 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 it's one of the people love night like ever rise. Hey, 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 hey.
Kaidan Gaskia of Niger with Africa.
Well, Yahayas, nearly a generation has passed since more than 800,000 people were killed in the Rwandan genocide. Now, after two decades, the country remains in the process of healing. Gabe Joslow catches up with young Rwandans in the capital of Kigali to see how they view their past and their future.
Members of a student genocide survivors group walk together to memorialize those who were killed 20 years ago. Still in high school, most here are too young to remember the fighting, though their lives were forever changed. Many lost family members, including their parents. They come to the Nyanza Memorial Site to grieve together and to offer support to each other. It's a kind of community service born out of the tragedy of the past. 20-year-old Fabian Akalakumatima leads education programs for the group.
It is important to come because it is the best way to honor the bodies, our parents, our friends that are buried in these graves.
The site memorializes some 2,000 people who were killed in April 1994 while taking shelter at a nearby school. Students say education is key to preventing a repeat of the past.
Through helping the young children who are growing up, I have to explain them clearly what happened, because there are some people who can explain to them in the wrong way.
The country still bears the scars of the genocide, but development is all around, and opportunity beckons a younger generation keen to rebuild the country. Christian Kwasinga and Marie-Jose Owayezu this year were accepted to Dartmouth College in the United States after studying with the Bridge to Rwanda program in Kigali. Both are looking forward to a better future for their country.
When you are getting an opportunity, you think that you have also to give an opportunity to someone else, because you know we are just being a one nation. That's the thing.
You can find that what has been harmed by the genocide, now, you know, there is, we are in in time of reconciliation and peace. And I believe, you know, that is not something that should affect anyone's thinking about what he wants to do in the future.
Through memorial and public service, Rwanda's younger generation keeps one eye on the past and another on the future. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
The World Bank has completed a preliminary report on Tunisia's development policy. The report details manipulation of socio-economic regulations by former Tunisian regime officials. Antonio Nusfero, a World Bank lead economist, tells Odette Fraser that the report aimed to ascertain whether the country's heavily regulated access to market system gave rise to the privileged few gaining primary access.
This study was undertaken as one of several background research pieces to contribute to a much larger report that the World Bank is preparing on Tunisia, which is called the Tunisia Development Policy Review, entitled The Unfinished Revolution. And that bigger report seeks to identify the barriers to faster economic growth and jobs creation in Tunisia.
How will this particular study impact the World Bank's relationship or commitment to development programs in Tunisia?
The focus of our research paper was not per se the predation of Ben Ali's family in Tunisia. Rather, we really wanted to understand whether in Tunisia the heavily regulated system of access to markets gave rise to rents for the privileged few who are able to receive these authorizations and enter those restricted markets. And our findings sort of go well beyond even our wildest expectations. If you read the study, you saw that they show that Tunisia's regulatory system enabled a very small number of about 220 firms connected to Ben Ali, and which accounted for less than 1% of jobs in the country, to take yet exceptional profits, accounting for more than 20% of all private sector profits in the country. Since the revolution in 2011, the World Bank, I guess, has been at the forefront of supporting the transition process in Tunisia. Very early in 2011, in partnership also with the African Development Bank and the European Union, we delivered a very significant amount of budget support to the government. We did the same in 2012, and we are just about to do so again. So we've been working with all the transition governments since the revolution. And in addition to the financing, we've also been incredibly active in terms of the advisory and technical assistance work. So the World Bank really is committed to Tunisia's transition. In terms of reforms that we have been working on and supporting the government on, indeed, these are the reforms that are needed and that the study sort of highlights as priority areas. We are talking about opening up the investment incentives code, which currently actually puts barriers to entry of domestic and foreign investors to large sections of the economy. We're talking also about easing up access to investors in several key backbone services sectors, such as telecommunications, air and maritime transport, retail and distribution, also the banking sector, and also to modify the competition law to ensure a better playing level field for all firms. With the IFC, the World Bank Group has been supporting the government in launching this type of regulatory simplification in 8 ministries that deal with private sector in the country. And right now, the discussions are in advanced phase where the government is liaising with the private sector to hear their views on what type of regulations are not needed, what should be simplified, and what is very expensive for the private sector.
How would you describe the economic climate in Tunisia at the moment?
I think, first of all, following the approval, the great consensus on the approval of the constitution earlier this year, there is in general a very positive, a very optimistic climate in Tunisia, which also spills onto the economic sector. The climate of political consensus is really helpful in terms of putting investors in the private sector, domestic and foreign, in a positive, giving Tunisia a positive outlook. In terms of the fiscal and monetary, I guess, policies, the situation is more difficult than it was 1 year or 2 years ago, in that the buffers have been reduced, and so there is need to take action to ensure the sustainability of public finances and also to maintain and build up foreign exchange reserves. But looking at this in a medium-term perspective, what is also important is indeed to go ahead with these reforms that we just mentioned. They are at the heart of private sector investment. They are at the heart of unleashing the capacity of the private sector to create jobs. And that is ultimately what we really pull Tunisia forward and ensure that the revolution also on the economic side achieves its objectives of bringing greater prosperity, shared prosperity to all Tunisians.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Concerned about the continuing violence in South Sudan, the United States has established a new authority to sanction those who are contributing to the crisis. President Barack Obama signed an order on April 3rd authorizing economic sanctions to be imposed on those in the troubled East African nation who threaten its stability or who commit human rights abuses. Specific individuals are not named, but the action grants the U.S. Treasury Department and U.S. State Department the authority to designate for sanctions those who obstruct the peace process, violate the January 23rd Cessation of Hostilities Agreement, or who commit human rights abuses. Under the order, any property held in the United States by an offending party would be blocked and its assets here frozen. Individuals and businesses receiving payment or assets from those sanctioned would also see those monies and assets blocked. The action is needed, President Obama said, because the ongoing widespread violence in South Sudan, the atrocities, human rights abuses, recruitment and use of child soldiers, attacks on peacekeepers, and obstruction of humanitarian operations constitute a national emergency. We call on all of South Sudan's leaders to honor their commitments by working quickly and earnestly towards an inclusive and comprehensive political dialogue. With the International Authority on Development and other partners in the region, we will continue to support the expedited release of those detained in Juba and elsewhere, and to ensure their meaningful participation in a political dialogue. Given the needs of the thousands of South Sudanese who have been displaced by the fighting, we also call on the parties to facilitate aid by humanitarian groups to all in need, regardless of location. The United States continues to stand with the people of South Sudan, the United Nations mission there, and all those working under difficult and dangerous conditions to alleviate the suffering and protect innocent civilians affected by the crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.